Thanks. Thanks so much. I really appreciate the Money Marketeers for inviting me to come in tonight. I hope, frankly, I hope you're doing better with your dual mandate than we are with ours. So this is a great venue to come and speak about how the Federal Reserve interacts with financial markets because of the focus and expertise that this group has. As was noted, I was here. Actually, my first speech as SOMA manager was here, and it was right about the time when we were winding down the first set of asset purchases. So now I'm back. We just finished the second round of asset purchases, so it seemed like a good time to go. So hopefully I won't be back for a third speech. So as you know, the Federal Reserve recently completed its second round of large-scale asset purchases, which inside the Fed we refer to as LSAT-2. To everyone else in the world, they call it QE-2. With the program now in the books, I thought it would be a good time to look back and assess the experience with LSAT-2. Specifically, I will discuss the effectiveness of the program related to its stated objectives, and I will describe some of the operational challenges that we faced in implementing it. Lastly, I'll touch on several issues related to the potential evolution of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet going forward. As always, my comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the Federal Open Market Committee or any other members of the Federal Reserve system. Okay, so let me just start with a few facts. I think most of you know the facts, but it's a good place to start. So the FOMC decided at its November 2010 meeting to expand the amount of domestic securities held in the System Open Market Account, or the SOMA portfolio, by $600 billion by purchasing longer-term treasuries through the end of June 2011. Those purchases were in addition to ones already being made to reinvest the principal payments from SOMA holdings of agency debt and agency MBS into longer-term treasury securities. The purchase program was implemented by the Open Market Trading Desk at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, which I'll refer to as the desk, which is a group that sits inside the markets group that I run at the bank. And about half of it's here tonight. So. So to be sure, this was a very busy period for the desk. So over the life of the program, we conducted 140 outright purchase operations to meet the directive that we were given by the FOMC. That essentially meant that we were active on nearly every single day possible over that period. In those operations, the desk bought $767 billion of Treasury securities. That included the $600 billion that was the expansion of the portfolio and $167 billion of reinvestments. Our operations ranged in size from just over $1 billion to around $9 billion, with an average size of about $5.5 billion. These operations brought the amount of domestic assets held in the SOMA portfolio to $2.654 trillion. So that was our bogey to hit. The current directive from the FOMC instructs the desk to continue to reinvest the principal payments on all domestic assets held in SOMA into Treasury securities. So thus, the amount of assets held in the SOMA will remain at that level until the FOMC decides to change the directive. So to state the obvious, the portfolio at these levels is unusually large. In the absence of the asset purchase programs, the size of the SOMA portfolio would be about $1 trillion, which is what would be required to meet currency demand and other factors. I have to keep it entertaining some ways. So at this point, we have about $1.6 trillion of additional assets in the portfolio as a result of the asset purchase programs. Another point is that the SOMA portfolio also has different characteristics than it would have in the absence of the asset purchase programs. Most notably, the overall duration of the SOMA portfolio at the end of June stood at just over 4.5 years, compared to its historical range of between 2 and 3 years. Together, the larger amount and longer tenor of our securities holdings results in a considerable amount of duration risk in the SOMA portfolio, meaning that the market value of the portfolio is sensitive to movements in interest rates. One measure of this risk that's familiar to market participants is the concept of tenure equivalence, or the amount of 10-year notes that would produce the same amount of risk in the portfolio. At this time, we have about $1.5 trillion of 10-year equivalents in the SOMA portfolio, which is about $1 trillion above the amount that we would have under our traditional portfolio approach. The majority of this additional risk came from the expansion of the balance sheet, but the extension of its average duration also contributed significantly. Transferring this additional duration risk to the Federal Reserve's portfolio, and hence out of the portfolio of market participants, was one channel through which the purchase program was intended to have its effects on financial conditions. So this is the portfolio balance channel that I've talked about before and that Chairman Bernanke has discussed on several occasions. This view associates the amount of policy stimulus with the stock of assets, or more precisely, with the amount of duration risk that the Federal Reserve takes onto its balance sheet. Okay, so let me turn to what I see as the policy achievements of LSAP 2. So the purchase of the asset purchase program was to help the Federal Reserve achieve the economic objectives of full employment and stable prices that was given to it by Congress. I believe that the program delivered what could have been expected of it in this regard. In particular, I'm going to highlight two successes in two dimensions. First, the LSAT 2 program made broad financial conditions more accommodative. This conclusion can be drawn from the behavior of financial markets from late August 2010 to the program's implementation date in November 2010, a period during which market participants moved from seeing such a program as a remote possibility to expecting it with near certainty. Asset price movements over this period included a decline in real interest rates, a narrowing of risk spreads, an increase in equity prices, and some weakening in the dollar, exactly the pattern that one would expect to be generated by additional monetary policy accommodation. Those changes likely supported economic growth and the creation of employment relative to what would have been realized in the absence of the program. Second, the LSAT 2 program appears to have raised inflation expectations from unusually low levels and reduced the threat of deflation. The downside risks to inflation had become quite threatening by last summer. Break-even inflation rates had moved to levels that were below those consistent with the FOMC's mandate, even for forward measures beginning several years ahead. In addition, the pricing of deflation risk, as computed by looking at tips with different amounts of accrued inflation, reflected fairly substantial odds of deflation over the next several years. Since that time, though, break-even inflation rates have risen back to levels more consistent with the FOMC's mandate, and the perceived risk of deflation has diminished notably. One criticism that has been directed at the LSAT 2 program is that it was unable to restore vigorous growth to the economy. So I think this is a reasonable observation, but it's not a very strong criticism. So it's true that the support to growth provided by the asset purchases appears to have been countered by other factors that have continued to weigh on growth. However, the LSAT 2 program was never described as such a potent policy tool that it could ensure the return to robust growth and rapid progress towards full employment in all circumstances. Despite its limits, the expansion of the balance sheet was seen by the FOMC as the best policy tool it had available at the time, given the constraint on traditional monetary policy easing from the zero bound on interest rates. The willingness of the FOMC to use this tool is indicative of a central bank that takes its dual mandate seriously and does what it can to deliver on it. The disappointing pace of recovery that has been realized since then suggests that the additional policy accommodation provided by the LSAT 2 program was indeed appropriate. Okay, so let me switch gears here then and move from the policy objectives of LSAP 2 to its actual implementation by the desk. So the FOMC set the broad parameters of the asset purchase program based in part on input from the desk on our capacity to conduct operations and on the market's capacity to absorb them. In particular, we wanted to complete the asset purchases in a timely manner, but we also wanted to ensure that the purchases were not so rapid so as to disrupt market functioning and liquidity in the Treasury market. In the end, I believe the program struck a good balance between these two considerations. I'd like to recognize the staff on the desk for their valuable input into the operational design of the program, as well as the effective implementation of the program over the past 8 months. Our presence in the market was sizable. Over the course of the program, our purchases ran at about the same pace as the total net supply of Treasury securities coming to the market. So essentially, the program took down about 100% of net supply. Moreover, with the completion of the program, the SOMA portfolio holds about 18% of the outstanding stock of Treasury securities. Our share of the market is even higher at intermediate maturities, where our purchases were concentrated. Part of the challenge to the desk was to structure our operations in a manner that would allow the markets to absorb such large volume of purchases. Several features of the program's design may have helped to promote robust participation by market participants, including the decision to relax the 35% limit on SOMA holdings for individual issues, and to include recently issued securities in the range of eligible issues in nearly every operation. These features allowed our counterparties to offer us a wide range of securities in each operation. In the end, dealers participated aggressively with an average offer to cover ratio of over 3.5. Moreover, we managed to execute these purchases at prices that were on average at or very near the indicative quotes on these securities that we collect as a pricing reference. In addition to focusing on the performance of our operations, we have also monitored measures of liquidity in the Treasury market. The market seems to be functioning well, despite our sizable presence. Measures such as bid-ask spreads, quote depth, and trading volumes have held relatively steady at favorable levels over the life of the program. Indeed, there are no signs that trading activity has been notably impaired for Treasury coupon securities, even in those issues for which our holdings are particularly high. Moreover, the market has not encountered any meaningful problems with delivery and settlement of Treasury securities. Lastly, I should note that the market seems to have adjusted fairly well to the end of the purchase program. The pace of the desk's purchases fell back sharply at the end of June as we moved from expanding the portfolio to simply reinvesting principal payments. In particular, our purchases slowed from an average pace of about $100 billion per month through June to an anticipated pace of about $15 billion per month going forward. So in terms of this debate that's been ongoing about, you know, is it the stock of our holdings that matter, or the flow of purchases, we essentially, at the end of June, ran a pretty aggressive experiment in the sense that the flow actually diminished quite quickly. And the reason was we didn't expect this adjustment to the pace of our purchases to produce any significant upward pressure on interest rates or any tightening of broader financial conditions, based on our view that the effects of the program arise primarily from the stock of our holdings rather than the flow of our purchases. While there's been considerable volatility in Treasury yields over the past several weeks, we attribute those movements primarily to incoming economic data and to broader risk events in the market. However, we will continue to watch the markets and assess their adjustment to the end of the purchase program. Okay, so that's what we've done so far. So far I've told you we've done a really great job implementing the program. I think what you may want to hear more about is what might happen going forward to the SOMA portfolio. So let me say a few words about that. But before I do, I just want to be clear. I'm not going to be saying anything about the likelihood of prospective policy actions beyond what's already been conveyed in FOMC communications. Still, I think I can make a few points about the portfolio under those prospective actions that have been described in other places. So as noted earlier, the current directive from the FOMC is to reinvest principal payments on the securities that we hold in order to maintain the level of domestic assets in the SOMA portfolio. This approach can be interpreted as keeping monetary policy on hold. Indeed, one can generally think of the stance of monetary policy in terms of two tools, the level of the federal funds rate and the amount and type of assets held on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. The FOMC has decided to keep both of these tools basically unchanged for now. Given the considerable amount of uncertainty about the course of the economy, market participants have observed that the next policy action by the FOMC could be in either direction. If economic developments lead the FOMC to seek additional policy accommodation, it has several policy options open to it that would involve the SOMA portfolio, as noted by Chairman Bernanke in his testimony last week. One option is to expand the balance sheet further through additional asset purchases, with the just completed purchase program presenting one possible approach. Another option involves shifting the composition of the SOMA portfolio rather than expanding its size. As noted earlier, a sizable portion of the additional risk that the SOMA portfolio has assumed to date came from a lengthening of its maturity, suggesting that the composition of the portfolio can be used as an important variable for affecting the degree of policy stimulus. Lastly, the chairman mentioned that the FOMC could give guidance on the likely path of its asset holdings, as the effects on financial conditions presumably depend on the period of time for which the assets are expected to be held. Alternatively, economic developments could instead lead to a policy change in the direction of normalization. The FOMC minutes released last week provided valuable information on the sequence of steps that might be followed in that case. The minutes indicated that the removal of policy accommodation was expected to begin with the decision to stop reinvesting some or all of the principal payments on assets held in the SOMA. If all asset classes in the SOMA were allowed to run off, the portfolio would decline by roughly $250 billion per year on average over the first several years. Under the interpretation of the monetary policy stance noted earlier, this shrinkage of the balance sheet would amount to a tightening of policy. However, one should realize that this step represents a relatively gradual and limited policy tightening. Indeed, using the mapping that has been discussed by Chairman Bernanke, this path of the balance sheet would, in terms of its effect on the economy, be roughly equivalent to raising the federal funds rate by just over 25 basis points per year over the course of several years. The minutes also described asset sales as part of the strategy, indicating that this step would likely occur relatively late in the normalization process. From the perspective of the balance sheet and the stance of monetary policy, sales accomplish the same thing as redemptions, as they also shrink the balance sheet over time. The minutes indicated that such sales are likely to be gradual and predictable, which makes them even more similar in nature to redemptions. Together, the combination of asset redemptions and asset sales, once underway, should put the size of the portfolio on a path to a more normal level over several years. Thus, they represent an important part of the normalization of the policy stance. However, if the approach follows the gradual and predictable path described by the minutes, one can think of this adjustment as a relatively passive part of the policy tightening. In these circumstances, adjustments to the federal funds rate would generally be the active policy instrument, responding as needed to economic developments. The sequence of policy steps described in the minutes indicates how the size of the SOMA portfolio is likely to be normalized. However, simply reducing the size of the portfolio would still leave its duration at historically elevated levels. The FOMC might decide it was happy with this outcome, or it could decide at some stage to renormalize the duration of the portfolio as well. Depending on the precise timing of the steps that would occur in the exit sequence, there will likely be opportunities to do so. For example, there's a good chance that the desk will still be selling MBS at the time when the SOMA portfolio gets back to its normal size. In such circumstances, the Federal Reserve would have to then engage in sizable Treasury purchases to offset the ongoing sales of MBS and to expand the SOMA portfolio as needed to meet currency demand and other factors. This period of Treasury purchases would allow the FOMC to rebuild the Treasury portfolio with the maturity structure that it sees as optimal. Let me end with a brief discussion of the prospects for income from the SOMA portfolio. The path of the balance sheet that's realized, along with the evolution of the term structure of interest rates, will determine the stream of income that will be realized from the SOMA portfolio. It's important to note that this income is not the objective of the asset purchase programs. The income from the SOMA portfolio is instead a byproduct of policy decisions taken by the FOMC to promote its economic mandate of full employment and price stability. However, because there seems to be considerable interest in the income produced by the portfolio, let me touch on it briefly. Given the uncertainty about how the balance sheet and interest rates may evolve, there is a wide range of outcomes for the income stream for the SOMA portfolio. At this point, if interest rates in the balance sheet were to unfold in the manner that appears to be expected by market participants, the asset purchase programs should produce a substantial amount of cumulative income. The SOMA annual report for 2010 presents some projections of the portfolio income under a representative set of assumptions for the evolution of interest rates and for the balance sheet. Under that projection, the portfolio produces about $500 billion of cumulative income over the 10-year period from 2009 to 2018, which is about $90 billion in excess of what we would project would have been the income realized in the absence of asset purchases. So that gives you some measure of the cumulative financial return from the asset purchase programs. And indeed, if we redid this calculation today with how interest rates have evolved since that annual report, we'd actually end up with a slightly higher number. Of course, the realized stream of income could differ substantially from these projections, depending on how interest rates and the balance sheet may evolve. In any event, it's worth repeating that the realized income is much less important than the economic outcomes that were achieved from the programs. Okay, so I hope these comments have provided you with some insights into how the SOMA portfolio has been managed to date and some perspectives on its evolution going forward. In general, the Federal Reserve will continue to have a meaningful presence in the Treasury market and in the agency debt and agency MBS markets for a number of years. However, with effective communications about potential balance sheet actions and careful implementation of any such actions by the desk, the markets should be able to adjust to the evolution of the SOMA portfolio without considerable problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. We're going to open it up to Q&A.
Right. So I see both of those as part of the directive. So essentially, the directive given to the desk is to reinvest maturing holdings in the SOMA portfolio. The way it's set up is that for maturing treasuries, those are done as at the auction. They're done as an add-on to the auction size. But of course, for maturing agency and MBS, we have to go out in the secondary market and purchase the securities. I think, you know, they both achieve the same thing. They both give us a treasury portfolio, but one is just can be done passively at auction, whereas the other requires operations.
One's taking securities from the public and the other is not.
Well, I think the other is, you know, if we weren't doing the rollovers at auction, the treasury would have to meet that funding need somehow. So they would presumably have larger auction sizes to the public, which would put more duration into the market and have kind of the exact same effect. So I think we're still preventing that duration from entering the market by doing it as an add-on at auction. So I think it's the same mechanics in terms of the effects on markets. It's just a different process for how we actually accumulate the securities.
Question?
Dana? Well, right now, interest on reserves is 25 basis points, but the Fed funds effect has been running around 6 or 7 basis points. Is the Fed doing, I'm assuming the Fed's doing studies on how much excess reserves need to be drained, at least temporarily, to get that relationship a little bit tighter. How do you go about studying that? How do you know how much excess is really excess and how much is demanded by banks?
So let me say, we do think, so we are relying on arbitrage activity by banks, right, to keep other short-term interest rates within a range of the interest rate on reserves. And we see this activity. Banks can borrow in the market at lower rates. They can hold reserves at the Fed and earn 25 basis points. So we do think that arbitrage activity is active. We do think it will remain active, and it will basically be the factor that should keep market interest rates within some distance of the interest rate on reserve. So that's how it works. Now, depending on what the FOMC decides for its directive, we may need to tighten up that relationship or manage reserves for other reasons. It's very hard to answer the question of just where we have to go with the amount of reserves. So normally, the FOMC asks, the economics team and the markets group to go out and look at things and kind of give them an answer on something. And we have data and we look at it. And we can't give them a very good answer because our econometrics, are imperfect and it's really hard to answer questions. But we'll have an answer. We'll have an estimate. This is a case where we actually don't have any data. We don't. So we can't even study, the relationship empirically if we wanted to. So we don't have any data in the U.S. markets where we had very high volumes of reserves very high volumes of reserves and higher levels of short-term interest rates. So I think the honest answer is, we're going to have to learn about that relationship. We're going to have to learn about, the strength of that arbitrage relationship and just, what trade-off we get between rates and reserves as we go. Certainly, we don't think the system, needs, between $1.5 and $1.75 trillion of excess reserves. I would assume the level of reserves is going to go down, but just how far down it goes is going to depend, I think, on what we learn about how interest rates respond, and we'll essentially learn as we go. So our goal so far has been to build the tools to make sure, we can get to whatever level of reserves proves to be necessary or desirable to the FOMC. And I think as we go along, the FOMC will decide just how far they want to go and what they want to achieve in terms of rates.
Brian, you co-authored a research report on the Dear Fed website that shows that QE1, it's called, helped to lower interest rates over short periods of time, particularly on the securities in which the Fed went into block. Yeah, when you look at interest rates during periods of QE, whether it's QE1 or QE2, it's pretty clear that during those periods interest rates rose. So I guess the question really is if the Fed lowered interest rates on those given days, or was the Fed overcharged by participants on those days? I'd like your comments on that.
Sure, happy to give the comments. right, we did the study on LSAP-1, please. And then, of course, we looked at the second round of asset purchases as well. I really believe that, as I said in the speech, if you want to try to figure out if LSAP-2 had an effect on markets, truly the best period to look at is that period from August to November. I mean, the markets, by the time we got to the November FOMC, the markets, were absolutely certain that the Fed was going to take this action. And actually, the discussion was, just how big could it go, right? So we would expect to see the effects in markets, ahead of the November meeting, not during the actual implementation of the policy. The other thing about that period is if you look back at it, it's a period where actually the data was relatively neutral and there wasn't a whole lot else, going on in the world. So we look at that configuration of asset prices, as I said, lower real rates, higher break-evens, higher risk asset prices, a lower dollar. And it's very hard to find any other explanation for that pattern other than monetary policy accommodation. So I think we feel pretty strongly that there's good evidence that LSAP-2 did make financial conditions more accommodative. Now, the second part of your question asks, well, maybe it just reversed and we just got ripped off and that's the story. My problem with that is I don't see how it's consistent with competitive financial markets. So this idea that the markets can always bid up the prices on us and then, once we buy them, prices are going to revert back to where they otherwise would have been, it just doesn't make sense. It's not, there would be some market participant who would want to take advantage of that pattern, if you knew that was coming, you could reap abnormal, gains by taking advantage of it. So I just, I personally don't buy that story. I think what happened after the November meeting is the data looked better. one. Two, the communications coming from the committee and elsewhere suggested maybe the programs weren't going to be as big as people were speculating, and so that got pulled back. So you had a bunch of other things happening that I think contributed to the rise in rates. But actually, let me add one thing, though. I will emphasize, though, that, you know, these tools are new, and you know, they're still being studied, and so, you know, we have our papers and we take estimates about their effects, but, you know, I don't want to leave an impression that, you know, we're overly confident in how exactly we've calibrated these effects. We completely recognize the degree of uncertainty about the effects of the tools.
There aren't too many market participants that can buy 18% of all treasuries. So, you know, it's hard to see the opposing person who's going to go against the Fed. In that instance, that's one thing I think you might want to focus on more. Brian, could you talk a little bit about what you think the transition mechanism was through which LSAT raised inflation expectations? Was it an announcement effect or a specific expectation about balancing adjustments?
So it's a great question because I think it's actually the part of the transmission mechanism that's, you know, probably the most murky to me. So the way I typically think about the asset purchase programs is they work through a portfolio balance channel. So they work through financial conditions. You know, yes, they should raise inflation expectations, but in that view, they would raise them because financial conditions are more supportive of growth, so then growth is going to help limit downside pressure on inflation. And I think what we saw is a much larger movement in break-evens and inflation expectations than you would probably guess from that channel alone. I will note that as a profession as a whole, I don't think we are very good at understanding how inflation, how expectations in general are formed. I think I would kind of put this in that category, that there seem to be, you know, looking at the evidence at face value, you'd say there's, you know, quite a large effect, and it seems, you know, somewhat outsized relative to the portfolio balance channel. So, again, you know, it's hard to model and understand how inflation expectations are formed. It's not clear that LSAP2 is the only thing in play over this period. As I noted, the data turned stronger and other things happened. So I think probably a variety of things helped to lift inflation expectations. But I think the aggressiveness of the monetary policy response, I would argue, seemed to contribute to that. Oh, an alumni question. I don't know.
My question is, you and your colleagues have put a lot of time into developing and testing credible exit strategy for monetary policy. And this has helped keep longer-term inflation expectations well anchored, which you would could argue has enabled an expansion of the balance sheet that otherwise would have been difficult to accomplish. And so my question is, are you concerned, given that one of the primary tools to ease, if required by the dual mandate, is to buy treasury debt, are you concerned that the lack of a credible fiscal exit strategy could constrain the FOMC in some future policy setting if further asset purchases might be required to achieve the dual mandate?
So the way I look at this is that you know, fiscal policy is obviously in the middle of an adjustment, and there's you know, a degree of uncertainty about, you know, how that's going to take place, what the size is going to be, and so on. I think monetary policymakers most likely would, you know, whatever the outcome is, would assess the implications for the economy in the context of its dual mandate. So I don't think there's kind of any additional consideration about, you know, whether fiscal's on a credible path or not credible path and so on. But obviously, the path of fiscal policy is going to have a large impact on how the economy evolves, you know, how much growth we get, and how, you know, the outlook for the dual mandate evolves. And, you know, better question for policymakers, but, you know, given historical behavior, my guess is that's the lens through which they would view your question.
I have to change topics a little bit.
So the liquidity swap lines with the foreign central banks are we regard as having no credit risk. These are extensions of reserves to the central bank. Those foreign central banks are the ones in turn providing funds to the firms in their jurisdictions. So the issues about collateral and credit risk on those transactions reside with the foreign central banks and not with us. Our exposure is to the foreign central bank. And we regard the foreign central banks as having no credit risk. Not only that, the transactions essentially are, you know, collateralized by the currency of the foreign central bank. So we regard those transactions as having absolutely no risk.
Who decided to start and stop the main lane sales and what's the margin?
So I'm not going to comment on the main lane sales, and I'm not going to do that because so actually the main lane portfolios are run in a different part of the bank outside of the markets group, so I just don't think it's appropriate to comment on it. Sorry.
Okay. Should we take one or two more questions?
Right. Yeah, that's great. That's
right. Okay. Back there.
Yeah, Brian, I'm just wondering, can you comment on what's being done in your Fed in particular
or
the
Fed in general in preparation for failure to raise the debt ceiling? No. I've been waiting for your question. So this issue obviously, you know, came up a lot last week in the chairman's testimonies. The chairman, what the chairman said actually, and I'll just quote what he said. The chairman said, you know, we would do what we could to preserve the operationality of the system. But I want to eliminate any expectation that the Fed, through any mechanism, could offset the impact of a default on the government on government debt. And he went on to talk about some of the negative consequences that could result. So that's a direct quote from the chairman. I don't think I really have anything to add to what the chairman said. Sorry.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Brian. Yeah. Thank you very much.